Welcome to Norse Mythology, the unofficial guide. It's unofficial because I'm neither a credentialed academic nor a time-traveling medieval Norse pagan, but I deal with this material directly from the sources, interpreted through the lens of the experts and their opinions. If you're looking for depth and detail in a simple and accessible way, then you're in the right place. I'm even less a map expert than I am a mythology expert. But I can still say pretty confidently that the human understanding of the globe is something that we've had to work on slowly and steadily over time. I'm not sure where you draw the threshold for the first complete world map, but the earliest map I could find that at least showed continuous coastlines for continents in both the east and west hemispheres comes from 1527. It's called the Padrón Real, and it's by Portuguese cartographer Diogo Ribeiro, and it relies on information gathered during Ferdinand Magellan's pioneering voyage around the world. Even then, it's still missing Australia and Antarctica. By now, all the gaps in our modern understanding of the Earth's geography have been filled in over hundreds of years of world travel and with things like satellite imaging. But imagine living in a context where the world might as well be stretching out infinitely around you in all directions. The world map, as you personally know it, is dark and unknown outside the areas where you've traveled. Of course, you're aware that others have traveled farther than you, and you do have access to material goods moving along the trade routes. But even if someone else in a land far, far away has already figured out the size and shape of the Earth using math and astronomy, that information probably isn't available to you personally. In this thought experiment, there's no internet or phones. And if this context is meant to resemble ancient Germanic society and its precursors, not even books. What you probably do know is that the farther away you get from home, the people start to look, sound, and behave more and more different from you. In fact, you may be aware that you can travel for thousands of miles and the world just keeps on going and going. Go far enough and the climate changes, and even the plants and animals become more and more different. What wonders might you discover if you could just travel far enough through that vast and unknown wilderness? This is something like the context the migratory Indo-Europeans were living in when they left the Eurasian steppe and started making their way across the Eastern Hemisphere. And it's still pretty close to what the average Scandinavian farmer was probably still experiencing 3,500 years later. Even by the time Norse Greenlanders made their way to North America, roughly around the time of Christianization, every new venture into the unknown was still yielding the discovery of new lands, new creatures, and new kinds of people. Abandoning our modern knowledge of the globe and even the greater universe is crucial for understanding ancient cosmological models. We have to keep in mind that whereas plenty of ancient societies have some concept of an unseen or inaccessible or higher world, they don't use terminology like multiverse and alternate dimensions. And the stars, for instance, are sparks from Muspel thrown into the sky by the gods. There's often no concept that some of these things are actually very much like the sun and that they might have other Earth-like planets circling around them. When we start to try and piece together a model of how the universe is shaped in the Norse mindset, it's easy to fall into the trap of leaning on famous drawings from the 19th century depicting things like nine spherical worlds nested in the branches of a giant tree floating in space. But this is problematic for a few reasons, not least of which is that there is no such thing as the nine realms of Norse mythology. The idea of the nine realms is one of the biggest and most pervasive misconceptions about our sources that has made it into the modern popular notion of Norse mythology. But to be fair, there is some nuance here, so let's start by breaking down this idea of the nine realms a little bit more than we did back in episode one. Between the two Eddas, which are our two core sources for Norse mythology, and wherein just about all of the pre-Christian, non-Euhemerized Norse mythological narratives are contained, the phrase nine realms appears exactly three times. There's also one mention of, quote, the ninth realm, and one mention of nine heavens, both of which exist only in the Prose Edda, which you may recall was written by a Christian scholar trying his best to reconstruct what was already a largely forgotten system. The phrase nine realms is translated from different grammatical inflections of Old Norse niu heimar. Niu is simple. It means nine. Heimar, or heimer in the singular, is a little more ambiguous. It's related to the English word home, and it can mean home. If we were to refer to a place like France, for example, as French home instead of France. It often denotes a region or country or land or territory or anything else indicating a place belonging to something. There's nothing implicit in this word telling us it has to refer to some huge location like an entire planet or extra spatial dimension or something like that. This is why you'll see it translated to realm so frequently in English. It's the closest word we have that matches the size ambiguity in Heimer. The most common list of nine realms you'll find in blog posts and video games and that sort of thing includes Alfheimr, Ásgarður, Hel, Jotunheimr, Midgarður, Muspelheimr, Niflheimr, Svartalfheimr, and Vanaheimr. But the big question here is, what makes these nine more special than all the other locations mentioned in the sources? Interestingly, some authors are savvy enough to know that the Prose Edda actually places Hel firmly within the bounds of Niflheimr. So in those cases, they will usually swap out Hel with a different place called Nidavellir. Unfortunately, this change doesn't account for the fact that, as we've talked about more extensively in prior episodes, the word Svartalfr only shows up in the Prose Edda, where it is very clearly used as a synonym for dwarf. And we're told in Völuspá that Nidavellir is a place where dwarves live. So now we have two names in our list, Svartalfheimr and Nidavellir, that both appear to be synonyms for a place where the dwarves live. We unfortunately don't know anything else about either of these locations. It's actually pretty easy to start finding problems with the traditional lists when we start looking for them, but that doesn't mean there's no such thing as the Nine Realms, and I did say that the phrase Nine Realms does exist in the sources. So what's the problem with the overall idea? Well, the first piece of the problem comes from the fact that the source material never provides a list of nine realms in any way, shape, or form. And that is striking, especially given that so many of our poems, including Völuspá, Grímnismál, and Vafthrúðnismál, are essentially lore encyclopedias that contain all kinds of lists. We get lists of Valkyries, lists of dwarves, lists of homes among the gods, lists of people's legendary ancestors. The Prose Edda even contains a list of nine heavens that all seem to be weather-related, given their names. But nobody, not even Snorri, ever provides a list of nine realms, much less a list that looks anything like these traditional ones. So let's take a look at how the phrase Niu Heimar actually gets used in the sources. We mentioned the first instance way back in episode 1. It comes from Völuspá stanza 2, quote, Ek man jotna arum borna. Thá forðu mikföðu hófðu, níu mannek heima, níu ívíði, mjóttvíð múran fyrmóð neðan. I remember giants born in early time. Those nurtured me long ago. I remember nine worlds. I remember nine giant women, the mighty measuring tree below the earth. End quote. Notice that this stanza does not tell us there is a sum total of nine worlds in existence, only that the seeress narrating the poem remembers nine of them. In episode 1, I mentioned a theory by Jens Peter Schutt, based in part on the wording of this stanza, that we ought to be interpreting the phrase Niu Heimar as meaning nine ages in time, rather than nine physical locations. I mentioned at the time that I didn't agree with the theory, but I appreciated the fact that he published it, because it just goes to show how little we know about what this phrase is really supposed to mean. The second instance comes from Vafthrúðnismál 43, quote, Frá jötna runnum og allra góða, ek kan segja satt, því at hvern hefek, heim of komet, níu komek heima, fyr niflhel neðan, hinnig döje or helju hallir. Of the secrets of the giants and of all the gods I can tell truly, for I have been into every world, nine worlds I have traveled through to Misthel, there men die down out of hell. End quote. The context in this reference is that Odin has just asked a jotun named Vafthrúðnir why he knows all the secrets of the Jotnar and the gods. The reply is that this is because Vafthrúðnir has traveled through nine worlds, which again doesn't necessarily imply that only nine worlds exist. But it does seem pretty likely in this case that this is Vafthrúðnir's way of saying that he has been everywhere a person can go. He notes that his journeyings concluded in a place called Niflhel, where he says men die down out of hell, whatever that means. But it ought to make us wonder why this seeming afterlife after afterlife location isn't typically included in the traditional lists of nine realms. Of course, Vafthrudnir does mention that this is how he knows all the secrets of the Jotnar and of the gods. So, is it possible that the nine realms could be a group of places known to the Jotnar and the gods? Well, it so happens that the poem Grimnismal gives us a list of 13 places had among the gods, which the poet appears to miscount as 12. We're told that Thor rules in Thrudheimr, Ullr rules in Udalir, Freyr rules in Alfheimr, someone called a god rules in Valaskjalf, Odin and Solga drink together in Sokvabekkr, Valhöll stands in Gladsheimr, Skadi lives in her father's ancient courts in Thrymheimr, Baldur rules in Breiðablik, Heimdallr rules in Himinbjörg, Freya arranges seating in a hall at Folkvangr, Forseti lives in Glitnir, Njörður rules in Noatun, and Vidar owns some unnamed land with high grass and wood. Now, as we've talked about before, it's entirely possible that some of the locations in this list are not necessarily different from others in the same list. For example, Valaskjalf, Gladsheimr, and Folkvangr. However, you will notice a striking absence of many of the names typically included in the traditional list of nine realms. For example, there's no Ásgarðr. And in fact, at first glance, that may make it tempting to assume that perhaps this list in Grimnismal is mainly meant to enumerate smaller regions within Ásgarðr, not full-on realms themselves. But if that's the case, we run into the problem that one of these regions is Alfheimr, which we are told is owned by Freyr. If Alfheimr deserves to be one of the nine realms, then shouldn't we include Thor's Thrudheimr as well? What about Udalr, owned by Ullr, or either of the other two Heimar in the list? The main problem with the traditional lists of nine realms is that there is really no good reason why certain locations have been included, while others have been excluded. The sources name many locations and are entirely unclear about any particular nine that deserve to be considered more important or overarching in some way. The third and last place the phrase nine realms is used comes from Gylfaginning 34 in the Prose Edda. Quote, Hel kasta thi han í Niflheim, og gav henni vald yfir nýju heimum, at hon skuldi skipta olum vista með þeim, til hennar roru sendir, en that sotdauðir menn og elidauðir. Hel he threw into Niflheim, and gave her authority over nine worlds, such that she has to administer board and lodging to those sent to her, and that is those who die of sickness or old age. End quote. This, of course, is given to us at the moment where the gods have discovered Loki's three children with Angerboda, and Odin is getting rid of all of them in unique ways. What's fascinating is that here again, there is no direct implication that only nine worlds exist, and no clue at all given as to which worlds are being referred to. What's a little bit interesting, though, is that Gylfaginning also includes a single reference to a ninth world that seems to correspond very nicely with the reference to nine realms from Vafthrudnismal, this time from section 3, quote, Og skulu allir menn lífa þeir rett eru síðaðir, og vera með honum sjálfum þar sem heitir Gimle eða Vingolf, en vandir menn fara til heljar og þaðan í Niflhel, það nýðar í nýunda heim. And all men who are righteous shall live and dwell with him himself in the place called Gimla or Vingolf. But wicked men go to hell and on to Niflhel, that is down in the ninth world. End quote. In this case, we're being told that Niflhel, and potentially hell as well, are down in the ninth world. So does that mean one or both of these together are the ninth world? Does it mean the ninth world is some other larger location with some other name encompassing both of them? Or, perhaps more importantly, what makes Niflhel the ninth world specifically? You'll notice that all three times the sources use the phrase nine realms, they are referenced in an indefinite grammatical sense rather than a definite one. The example I typically use to illustrate the difference is to say, imagine that I told you I saw nine flowers. This phrasing is indefinite. It doesn't tell you which flowers I saw or how many flowers exist. Only that I saw nine of them. This is how our sources use the phrase nine realms. On the other hand, imagine that I told you I saw those nine flowers. This phrasing is definite. It implies there's a specific set of exactly nine flowers that you and I are both aware of. The sources never use this kind of phrasing when talking about nine realms. To be fair, Norse poetry does tend to try and avoid definite articles in most cases. However, it's worth noting that one out of our three references to this phrase is in prose, and it is similarly indefinite. This in itself doesn't prove that the ancient concept of nine realms was always indefinite, but I bring it up here to illustrate that we have absolutely no attestations at all of it being definite, or in other words, of it being a discrete, well-known list of nine realms. And as I've already mentioned, we are never given even a decent hint as to what any list like this ought to include. What we do know, as I mentioned in episode 1, is how important the number 9 is, both religiously and poetically, in Norse and more broadly Germanic culture. With that in mind, there are two fun theories we can start to piece together about the phrase nine realms. The first starts to take shape when we notice that every single time this phrase is used in the sources, there's an association with death. In Völuspá, the seeress who narrates the poem is almost certainly already dead, having been temporarily resurrected by Odin. She remembers nine realms. In Vafthrudnismál, a journey through nine realms ends in Niflhel, where men die down out of hell, which is echoed in Gylfaginning 3 when we're told in a very Christian-sounding way that wicked men go to the ninth world when they die. Then lastly, in Gylfaginning 34, Hel is given authority over nine realms to take charge over people when they die. In this light, we might start to wonder whether these realms have some very specific meaning in relation to death. Maybe they are intended to be nine realms of the underworld. Maybe Schutt was onto something with his idea about ages and time, and this is some kind of representation of a progression towards the end, or perhaps a reference to different stages in a person's life with hell at the end. But personally, I think the most likely answer is that the phrase nine realms is just a poetic way of saying everywhere in the world, maybe not too dissimilar from a phrase like sailing the seven seas. I'm pulling this from mainly four pieces of evidence. First, I think the fact that Vafthrudnir ends his journey through Nine Realms in Niflhel is probably the one and only reason Snorri called it the Ninth World in Gylfaginning. If Hel slash Niflhel slash Niflheimr was anciently considered the Ninth Realm, or if this is Snorri's interpretation, either way, it could simply be because the Realm of the Dead is the last realm where everyone eventually travels. Secondly, nine is an absurdly common number in pagan-era poetry that seems to be used almost any time a poet needs to tell us how many items are in a group that's larger than three. Regardless of how many locations may be named throughout the source material, if a poem is going to mention a numeric group of them, we honestly ought to be a little surprised if the number we're given is anything other than nine. Third, as I mentioned, we always see an indefinite nine realms and never a definite the, these, or those nine realms, even in prose. So we have no indication that there was ever a specific set of nine named realms that people were actually expected to know. Lastly, I think it's telling that no list of nine realms is ever listed out for us, even though so many of our poems take special care to make all sorts of lists of important things. And of course, if you go through all the locations described in the sources yourself, trying to piece together which ones ought to be considered part of a special nine, you will have a very difficult time explaining why certain realms should be included and others should be excluded. But if the phrase Níu Heimar was never meant to imply that there are nine planets floating around on Yggdrasil's branches, and that part at least is certain, it means that they have to be somewhere. And if they're not distant planets or alternate universes or extra dimensions, where are they? Where's Ósgarðr, for example, or Jotunheimr? Snorri gives us a cosmological model in the Prose Edda that we've used pretty extensively so far on this show, but it's worth noting that this model has been criticized in varying degrees by different scholars, either for being too heavily influenced by Christianity or for being too rigid. So I think it's time we took a closer look at it. In Snorri's version of the story, after Odin and his brothers kill the primordial Jotunheimr, they create the world out of different parts of his corpse. Whereas previously, there had only been a misty cold realm in the north and a burning hot realm in the south, with a giant empty void between them. The gods create land from Ymir's body and oceans from his blood. They create the dome of the sky from his skull and the clouds from his brain. In the center, they place the lands of Midgarður, where humans live, and they surround it with a ring-like sea, and then place lands for the Jotnar beyond the sea. Ásgarður itself is described as being somewhere within Midgarður, somehow existing simultaneously, quote, both on earth and aloft, end quote. And various other places are described as being, quote, in heaven. For instance, Urðarbrunnr, where the Norns hang out, and most of the dwelling places of the gods, are placed by Snorri up in heaven. The location of Yggdrasil is not entirely consistent in Snorri's version, but he does make mention of how both its roots and branches are positioned within the world. In Gylfaginning 15, he explains, quote, "The ash is of all trees the biggest and best. Its branches spread out over all the world and extend across the sky. Three of the tree's roots support it and extend very, very far. One is among the Æsir, the second among the frost giants, where Ginnungagap once was. The third extends over Niflheim," end quote. So, in the only description of the location of Yggdrasil's branches, we are told that they extend across the sky, spreading out over all of the singular world. Snorri explains that its three roots are among the Æsir and Hrimthursar and extend over Niflheimr. A few sentences later, he adds that that third root, or in other words, the one extending over Niflheimr, also, quote, extends to heaven, and beneath that root is a well which is very holy, called Weird's Well. There the gods have their court. Every day the Æsir ride there up over Bifröst, end quote. Note that he's already told us one of these roots is among the Æsir, but that a different root extends to heaven, where Urðarbrunnr is located, and that the gods have to traverse Bifröst to get there every day. This is just slightly different from what we learn about these roots in Grimnismal 31. Quote, "Three roots there grow in three directions under Yggdrasil's ash. Hel lives under one, under the second, the frost giants, under the third, humankind," end quote. The main difference between these two explanations is that whereas Snorri tells us one of the roots lies among the Æsir, Grimnismal places this root among humans. I tend to prefer Grimnismal's version for various reasons. For one, it's pre-Christian, so it doesn't keep trying to force everything up into heaven like in Snorri's version, where his obsession with placing all divine locations in heaven seems to require him to make one of these roots take a weird right-angle turn straight up into the sky so that it can be placed near Urðarbrunnr. Grimnismal's description also looks to me like Yggdrasil's roots are demarcating the singular world into three overarching realms: the realm of humans, which we see and experience every day, the realm of Jotnar, which is largely supernatural and otherworldly in a sense, and of course the realm of the dead. Another issue with Snorri's model is that it appears to place the lands of the Jotnar in a ring outside the donut-shaped sea that encircles Midgarður. This makes sense in light of the way ancient farms and forts were laid out, placing a hall and a tree in the center, surrounded by a circular enclosure separating the inner home area from the outer wild area. However, if the lands of the Jotnar lie in a ring around this sea, it leaves us to wonder why Thor always has to travel to the east when he goes out hunting for evil Jotnar. It also doesn't jibe very well specifically with the story where Thor goes fishing for Jormungandr. Remember that Snorri places the world serpent in the donut-shaped sea surrounding Midgarður. But in this story, after traveling east all the way to Heaven's End to reach the home of the Jotunheimir, Thor must then row further out into the sea to reach the place where the serpent lies. So in this case, it would appear that Jormungandr encircles the lands of the Jotnar as well. One scholar, Eldar Heida, wrote a fascinating paper about this called Contradictory Cosmology in Old Norse Myth and Religion, but Still a System, back in 2014. In this paper, Heida presents an idea for a Norse cosmological model that I think comes very close to what reality probably was in ancient times, so we'll go through it together. My main critique of this paper is that he uses certain language and terminology like bubbles and passageways that can be hard to see past when trying to comprehend the fundamental idea he's really trying to convey. But he starts off strong by summarizing previous scholarship, acknowledging the inconsistencies in the source material, and providing a great list of some really fascinating points that showcase relative locations between places in the sources. With regard to Hel, for example, this is a place that is often described as underground, but when a character journeys there, they typically do it by riding northward and down, over an above-ground road, or even by having their bodies shoved out to sea in a boat, which is then set on fire. When Skirnir begins threatening the Jotun woman Gerðr in an attempt to get her to marry Freyr, he tells her that she will be placed up high in an eagle's nest, turned towards Hel, with her back to the world, indicating that Hel seems to be a place outside the rest of the community and far away from everything. To reach Gerðr in the land of the Jotnar, Skirnir has to travel across wet mountains and through both darkness and a flickering flame. Although Thor consistently makes his travels into the east, and although Völuspá supports this idea by mentioning that the Jotnar will sail into the Battle of Ragnarok from the east, Snorri places Gerðr and other lands of the Jotnar in the north. And another Jotun, Surtur, is of course set to come up from the south at Ragnarok. Snorri's model is somewhat supported, however, by various sources in which water does have to be crossed in order for the gods to reach the Jotnar or for them to reach each other. And if not water, it's the rainbow bridge, or it's flight through the sky, like Thor with his chariot, or like Loki with his feather skin. As I mentioned, Hymir is said to live east of the river Elivagar at Heaven's End. Heaven's End is also where we are told the eagle-shaped Jotun Hrasvelgr sits creating the wind. But Jotnar can also show up right in the middle of the world. The poem Harbardsljóð depicts Thor fighting enemies on the real-life Danish island of Lasse, for instance. Skaldskaparmál even names the character of Ægir as a person from Lasse, assuming we are supposed to understand this as the same Ægir who throws feasts for the gods. The poem Hymiskvida calls him a mountain dweller, putting him in line with various other Jotnar who live inside mountains, such as Gunnlóð, from whom Odin steals the meat of poetry, after slithering in snake form into her mountain home through a hole drilled by an auger. The gods themselves are hard to pin down. With regard to different sources, the gods tend to live opposite wherever the Jotnar live. If the Jotnar are to the north, that's to the north of where the gods are. If they're to the east, that's to the east of wherever the gods are. If this means the gods are in the center of the world, that works pretty well with the idea that they are located somewhere near Yggdrasil, as supported by Grímnismál. However, the poem Lokasenna alludes to the fact that Njörður was once sent eastward as a hostage to the gods, which could mean either that the gods are located somewhere in the east, or that Ægir's Hall is somewhere far to the west. If Snorri's idea is correct that Njörður was sent as a hostage by the Vanir, this could mean that the land of the Vanir is somewhere in the west, and possibly near Ægir's Hall. Then there's some weird underwater stuff. We are told that Frigg lives in a place called Fensalir, meaning the Fen Halls. Odin and the goddess Solga drink together in a place called Sökkvabekkr, which means sunken bench, while the waves roll over above them. Heimdallr's home, on the other hand, is called Himinbjörg, which means Heaven's Mountain, where he guards the rainbow bridge against the Jotnar, and which is about as opposite from underwater as you can get. Sometimes water has to be crossed to reach Valhöll as well. In Gesta Danorum, Saxo describes a horse ride from the realm of men across the ocean to the home of Odin. In Grimnismal's prose introduction, two brothers end up going astray in their boat while fishing and end up on some coastline where they meet Odin and Frigg, dressed as peasants. In Frá Dauða Sinfjotla, a character named Sinfjotli is poisoned to death and is then taken across a river by Odin, whereupon the two disappear. And we learn from the poem Eriksmál that Sinfjotli has ended up in Valhöll, a place that Helgakvida Hundingsbana 2 describes as west of Heaven's Bridge, and has the hero Helgi arriving there by way of, quote, the flight road, which would seem to imply that it is somewhere in heaven after all. Except that back in Gesta Danorum, the hero Hadingus ends up in a place that looks very much like Valhöll after following an old woman down through the floor near the hearth. There's also a fascinating little tidbit in Eyrbyggja saga, where a Thor worshipper named Thorstein Thorskabitr drowns, but one of his servants sees a mountain in Iceland, called Helgafjell, become opened up on the north side, and inside of it there's a very Valhöll-like scenario going on, with large fires and tons of clamoring people making a great clanking of drinking horns. And the servant hears from these people that Thorstein has been received into this place and invited into the high seat next to his father, who has also passed on. I don't want these examples to go on forever, But Haida also notes a few reasons to believe that Valhöll was sometimes thought to be accessible by various passageways underwater as well. One of the main takeaways from all this, especially when we start combining it with even further examples of more localized folk belief and ideas found in more sagas, is that the means by which a person could travel to the other world are likewise localized, just as we ought to expect from an ever-evolving oral system where the line between religion and folklore isn't exactly clear. But in spite of all these seeming contradictions, Haida still detects a system that would allow us to get some kind of picture of the overall mythological landscape of the world. Haida believes that gods and humans don't live in the same realm. Instead, gods and other supernatural creatures live in what he calls Otherworld, and which he defines as, quote, the world beyond that which is reachable by natural means, end quote. Any given realm, therefore, has some maximum distance one can travel, some maximum height that can be attained, and some maximum depth that can be reached by natural means prior to the existence of modern technology. And this constitutes what he calls a very wide, very flat bubble. But this doesn't mean that the bubble is trapping you in. It's not a literal physical bubble with some membrane around it. There is more to be found beyond the area where you can travel by natural means. It's just getting there that's the problem, since it's beyond your natural reach. Enter the concept of passageways. Haida describes passageways sort of like supernatural portals one can pass through to move between the realm of the gods, the realm of the Jotnar, and the realm of humans. These include things such as traveling through the sky, crossing the ocean, traveling to the edge of the world or to where the sun rises or sets, passing through darkness, climbing high mountains, venturing into the earth, diving deep into water, moving up and down the world tree or something that symbolizes it, and by performing rituals at places where the landscape is different or unusual. For example, groves, waterfalls, caves, and that sort of thing. This doesn't mean that these different realms are actually located underground or underwater or in the sky or whatever. And in fact, the same realm can often be reached by means of various different kinds of passageways. Haida notes, for example, that Odin has to enter Gunnlöð's court by boring into a mountain, but is able to leave by just flying away in the form of an eagle, completely unobstructed by the mountain. Ultimately, Haida believes there is good basis for a geographical model where Yggdrasil is in the center, surrounded by the realm of the gods, and that this is surrounded by the realm of the humans, which is in turn surrounded by the realm of the Jotnar. He reiterates a point I've made a few times on the show in saying, quote, in Iron Age agricultural society, most people inhabited a personal environment that often had a farmyard tree in the middle, surrounded by houses and the cultivated land, outside of which lay the areas that were uncultivated but still resourceful, housing powers over which one did not exercise control. This is in accordance with the world of the gods, having the world tree in the middle, surrounded by the homesteads of the gods, outside of which are all the others, whom the gods do not fully control, but which represent important resources and potential. However, the other realms do not keep a mythogeographical location in relation to the realm of the gods, nor in relation to each other. Each realm, for instance, Hel and the individual Jotun homesteads, is instead closed within itself, like a bubble. The different realms are not situated in one or another direction from other bubbles, nor inside others, but they have interfaces with, and passageways to, other bubbles. They are not located in any geographical coordinates, but simply beyond the passageways. End quote. This is the whole crux of the idea. Each of these realms surrounds the other, similar to the way Snorri describes it. But within any otherworldly realm, there is no fixed geography or consistent navigability from one place to another. Each individual location works sort of like a bubble, requiring passageways in order to go in or out. It's a good idea, but I personally think it falls a little short in the way things are described. Haida notes that mythological geography is always tied to myths and is subordinate to narratives. Only two worlds are ever in focus at a time, and there is no canonically accurate physical map of the cosmos being shared among ancient Norse pagans. So now we're going to take a passageway out of the realm of expert analysis for a moment, into the bubble of my own interpretation that draws pretty heavily from Haida's, but is maybe even a little less rigid. At the beginning of this episode, I asked you to imagine the world almost like a potentially infinite canvas of mappable territory, in a context where most of what we've learned about the Earth in the last 1,000 years is inaccessible. Imagine that you are looking down at this canvas, preparing to draw a map of the known world. You begin by drawing your home and the neighborhood around you. You continue drawing until you've filled in every place you've ever been. But as you take a step back, it's clear that everything you've drawn, including all the towns you visited and all the coastlines you know, constitute only a small fraction of mappable space on this otherwise empty canvas. You know that somewhere in the center of this world ought to be the Axis Mundi, the tree Yggdrasil. So you take a few steps far away from the place on the canvas where you've drawn the world you know, and you draw a tree. You know there ought to be a well here, and a hall owned by the chief of the gods, so you draw those as well. Maybe you even have some idea in your mind how the homes of the gods are mapped out, so you draw a full town here and label it Ósgarðr. You see that Ósgarðr is separated from the world you know by a vast area of unknown territory. And if you're being honest with yourself, you've really only guessed at where the center of this canvas should be. Should Ósgarðr really be to the east of you or to the west? Is it a little more north or south? You can't be sure. All you know is that it's somewhere that's supposed to be the center, and you've chosen a way to represent that on your map. On the other hand, you know that the realm of the Jotnar ought to be out there somewhere in the world as well. So you walk back past your known world on the map, a few steps in the other direction, and start drawing some places you remember from mythology. You draw Thrymheimr, Geirröðargarðr, and various other Jotun homesteads. But where should they be in relation to each other? You aren't sure. You just know that they are somewhere way out beyond anywhere you've ever been, and so way out there on the canvas you draw a few little independent areas of detail. Between all of these locations, there are great swaths of empty canvas, representing unknown terrain that would have to be crossed in order to reach these areas. In this sense, each filled-in area of the map is somewhat similar to one of Haida's bubbles, but there's no reason to think they are independent realms of existence that are completely unreachable except by magical means. Instead, they're all part of the same world. It's just getting to them that's the problem, since they're beyond your natural reach, and you have no idea exactly where on this potentially infinite map they should be. But in the stories you tell your children and grandchildren, gods, Jotnar, and humans sometimes need to visit each other's worlds. We've got to have some way to get there. So what do your characters do? They cross nearly impenetrable barriers like high mountains and nearly impossible distances like vast oceans all the way to Heaven's End, or they take supernatural bridges through the sky that could lead them from here to there to anywhere, or they wander into liminal and mysterious spaces such as darkness or caves, or they get lost at sea, spaces where it's impossible to know exactly what geography is around them and even how far they've gone. And then, coming out on the other side of this kind of space, they find themselves in an otherworld of sorts. In some cases, they'll reach these areas simply by passing through magical doorways. As Haida and I would agree, none of this means these otherworldly locations have to be in the sky or underground or anything of the sort. You simply need a narrative way to get your character from a known place on the map past the unknown empty canvas to another known place on the map. And in that respect, it doesn't matter exactly where these locations are in relation to each other. And we can still easily say that the realms of gods, humans, and Jotnar loosely surround each other in some way. They can simultaneously be part of our world and also the supernatural otherworld. What I'm trying to avoid here with my own spin on Haida's take is rigidity. In a context where there may not be many cosmological maps circling around, and given that cosmology is something that has to be passed from generation to generation, largely by average folk, it makes sense to me that we need a simple system that allows for fluidity and easy transmittal. But even if this interpretation is correct, there are still some tough questions raised by conceptualizing the world in this sort of pattern of concentric circles. For example, where exactly is the realm of the dead in this model? The author of Grimnismal apparently thought it was important enough to dedicate an entire route of Yggdrasil to it. Should we agree that it is kind of northward and downward, as a lot of sources suggest? Does that mean we should consider it part of Niflheimr? And would that mean we have to canonize Niflheimr as part of Jotunheimr? And how exactly can you, in your daily life, interact with beings located in places so far away? Because we do know that Jotnar interfered with the human world all the time, and that humans were able in various ways to interface with their deities. Hayden notes that modern religions are still tackling these types of problems today. He gives the example of a Christian widow who believes her husband is in heaven, but when she wants to speak with him, she visits his grave. She doesn't have to make the journey all the way to heaven, wherever that is, to communicate with her husband, because the place where the body has been laid is special in a way, and it serves as a kind of linking point between the living wife and the deceased husband. Similarly, a pagan temple or a sacred grove or a tall post in the middle of town or an idol carved out of wood can all constitute linking points to the other world when it is unrealistic to make a journey all the way there. In some way, in a more animistic worldview, something like an idol of Thor, for example, can literally be considered Thor himself, existing in your world, or possibly an aspect of him. But at the same time that Thor is sitting in some sacred space near your house, he is also sitting in other sacred spaces throughout the region, and can simultaneously be thundering through the sky in his chariot on his way to impersonate Freya at a wedding. These are the kinds of things gods can do, and they don't really pose a cosmological problem. Supernatural beings also tend to be a little better than we are at having the ability to reach beyond what we can naturally. They have horses like Sleipnir that can ride over the sea and sky, and great shimmering bridges that can connect to any point in the world. They also tend to be a bit more aware of how to purposefully navigate liminal spaces or magic doorways than we might be. But of course, we can't exactly expect every ancient Norse pagan to have conceptualized the locations of all these places in exactly the same way. Asking a question like, "Where is Alfheimr?" for example, could be answered in tons of different ways by tons of different people. Where exactly any person believes Alfheimr might be could depend on what that person believes an elf is, or whether they consider Alfheimr to be a divine place, whether or not they are aware that Alfheimr is supposed to be owned by Freyr, as stated in Grimnismal, or a hundred other factors. On the one hand, if elves are all around us, influencing things in our daily life, then linking points to Alfheimr, or even Alfheimr itself, may be all around us. And in that case, Alfheimr could be reached by traveling in pretty much any direction, depending on who you ask. But to me, there's a difference between accepting the fact that we can't create a full and accurate map of the cosmos versus claiming that the cosmos is unmappable or separated in some non-naturally navigable way. And even though this is the sort of thing scholars are still speculating about, there's also a big difference between presenting a cosmological model that at least makes some sense in light of what we know versus presenting a model that only makes sense to people in modern times, involving magical machines that open bright rainbow-colored wormholes into other dimensions or universes. Whether or not my interpretation or Hayden's or some other scholars is correct, I think it's worth something as long as we're all wandering the unknown canvas of history together, trying to fill in the map in sensible ways. So let's you and I get lost in the misty sea and see where we end up again next time on Norse Mythology, The Unofficial Guide. Sources for this episode include Contradictory Cosmology in Norse Myth and Religion, But Still a System by Eldar Heda, 2014. The Poetic Edda, translated by Caroline Larrington, 2014, and The Prose Edda, translated by Anthony Falks, 1995.